The news this week has been pretty well dominated, not internationally by any means, but internally, by a number of items on the home front here in the UK. But there's one item that has been quite prominent in the news, and it's linked to the Christmas trade that, I say trade, the Christmas concepts where the revelry and everything else that is taking place by so many at this particular time of year. And the area that is really causing concern and is on the news almost most nights at this present time is binge drinking by the young. Now, I've got a number of articles from the papers of the past few days. And there was one here that says, "We are the champions, sex, drugs and now binge drinking, how Britain's teens lead the world." It says, binge drinking has reached epidemic levels amongst teenage girls who are outstripping boys for the first time. So the actual girls are even worse in this particular regard than the boys themselves. Figures show Britain is among the worst in Europe for teen drunkenness and alcohol abuse, and an enviable record means that some girls in their late teens are being treated for cirrhosis, which normally affects adults who are decades older. So these are actual girls, because apparently the body chemistry of a girl doesn't handle drink the same as a man can. So in fact it's almost like a double whammy. It says, Professor Martin Plant of the University of the West of England said the Home Office proposals for a 24-hour pub opening sent out a message that conflicted with the effort to reduce the harm caused by alcohol. He said he was very worried about 24-hour licensing and the lack of joined-up thinking in the government. Evidence from other countries show that this has been followed by huge leaps in violent crime, he said. How is the young lone female going to get home safely at 4 a.m. when she's too drunk to drive and there's no public transport? Now, the reason there's no public transport is not just the time, but it's also that they're cutting back on public transport as well. Another one, it says, there's one accolade we could certainly do without. A study of European teenagers has found that Britain is among the top achievers for antisocial behaviour. The research from the European School Survey project of alcohol and other drugs shows British teenagers sub-reported some of the highest levels of binge drinking, drunkenness, alcohol-related problems and drug use in Europe, with an especially striking rise in binge drinking among girls. It says the immediate reasons are obvious. This is another area. It says, we inhabit a materialistic consumer culture which has made a fetish of the self and worships at the shrine of the instant gratification. Now this lady, Melanie Phillips, who's writing this particular article, I think has got a lot of sense in what she says. She says, but these changes have taken place in other countries too. So why has Britain become a world leader in teenage disorder? Our children have been taught to expect that there are likely to be only minimal consequences for antisocial behaviour. And it goes on and shows that in other countries there is zero tolerance. It says, instead of promoting sexual continence among the young, we have sex education, in quotes, which seems designed to encourage sex act between pubescent children, which would not be out of place in a brothel, along with the casual provision of abortion and the morning after pill. Instead of supporting and encouraging married family life, we've had forced down our throats the false doctrine that all family lifestyles are of equal value. And again, that is true. So, you know, what they actually have. The resulting fragmentation of the family is perhaps the greatest single cause of the rise in drug-taking, drinking, and other self-destructive behaviour arising from the increasing distress and the confusion of children. And that is true. The more confusion there is, so the more the kids basically go and try and drown their sorrows and get rid of it out of their mind. So there's not the stability there. She goes on and says, the question still remains why British society is so much more irresponsible than elsewhere. The first reason is surely the decline of organised religion and the part played by the Church of England in embracing rather than fighting the erosion of the moral standards. The second is the impact of the British secular church, the welfare state, which has created our me society of rights and entitlements and eroded the sense of duty and obligation that keeps a country civilised. The third is the collapse of the national self-belief and the loss of Britain's sense of purpose. It's actually Britain's self sense of purpose that is the problem. So that the biggest selling point for regenerated cities is now all-night entertainment based on drinking and gambling. And that's what they have. You know, you go and you find what they put in there, the regeneration of cities. What is it that they promote? It's this kind of thing. With an adult culture drifting into this kind of decadence, it is hardly surprising that it has produced a lost generation, the children it has abandoned, who have become the antisocial champions of the world. So that is what we're looking at within society over here in the UK. And it certainly fits, there's a fair number of areas that we can actually look at. Let's have a look at one scripture, Isaiah 28, verse 1. Isaiah 28. And you think, well, how did God know when Isaiah 28 was written, how did God know that this also, because it's also been preserved for our day today, how did he know that this was going to be a problem in today's society? And the answer really is in the article I just read you. He knew that the decadence of the society would go in a certain direction, and as she gave the three points, it was an erosion of the religious morals, the religious ideas and concepts, the part played by the Church of England. The second is the impact of the welfare state. In other words, that basically is a me society in rights and entitlements. And the third is that collapse of national self-belief and the sense of purpose as a nation. And, you know, you've only got to go into the other collapses of empires. And here was Ephraim, who was going to go ahead and rise first and also fall first behind, Manasseh. And so God could see that, yes, there would also be a problem of drunkenness. And Isaiah 28, verse 1, it says, "Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim." And you only have to see the kids out loose on the street, and the pride that is there. "Whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which is on the head of the fat valleys and of those that are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord has a mighty and strong one, which is a tempest of hail and a destroying storm and a flood of mighty waters overflowing, shall cast down to the earth with the hand." And it talks about the Assyrian, the rod of my anger, the strong one. "The crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, shall be trodden under feet." And you can read much of what, in fact, will take place at that time. But this is a problem, and it is stemming from a culture. There's another one from Thursday, the 9th of this month. It says, "The government policy of driving mothers with young children out to work is one reason for the rise of yobbish behaviour," says Frank Field, the former Labour Minister of Welfare Reform. In a speech today, Mr. Field will call for mothers to be given a real financial incentive to stay at home during their children's early years. And he called for more stay-at-home mothers and puts him at odds with the government, particularly Gordon Brown, who last week used his pre-budget statement to unveil proposals for a 10-year framework for childcare. So on one hand, they're saying, no, well, we've got to go ahead and provide for mothers to go out to work so they provide the childcare. And on the other hand, they see the problem there. And some of them do. They see the problem of the yob culture, which in fact it's not the root. As I always remember one minister saying that the cause of the problems in the home wasn't when the mother went out to work, it was when the father went out to work. The fact that the children don't see their father is the beginning of the rot. Now, obviously, the fathers are going to have to go to work, but when they work away from the home and is totally divorced from the home and takes them away for days at a time, then there is a problem there. There's an article here which I'm not going to have time to read, which is called "Too Much Too Young." It says, "On Friday and Saturday nights, casualty departments in the UK overflow with drunken teenagers, some of whom are scarred for life and after fights and accidents. And there are three initiatives trying to reverse the dramatic increase of underage drinking." And it goes through how they have actually these buses that go around the area, and they are basically picking up teenagers who are so under the influence of drink. They've just got somewhere that they can recover without getting hypothermia, because obviously alcohol opens the surface blood vessels and can actually cause hypothermia, the cooling of the central core, and death. So they look after this area. In Cardiff and in Swansea, they have actual clinics that have moved onto the streets. They've actually put them into the centres of the towns now to treat the casualties that they anticipate over the Christmas period, particularly yesterday, and so yesterday's Friday evening, because of this problem. There's one here, it's from today. It says, millions of revelers were celebrating the first night of the holiday last night, and for emergency service it was shaping to be the traditional Black Friday. The police and ambulance service recognised the last Friday before Christmas break as one of the worst nights of the year. And it goes on, in Wales, where many factories and offices closed yesterday, field hospitals were set up to cope with the thousands of young people pouring into the centres of Cardiff and Swansea to celebrate. And in Cardiff, the treatment room at the Millennium Stadium was turned into a MASH-style medical unit, and in Swansea, a city centre doctor practice was taken over, and both were manned by paramedics and experienced casualty nurses, and both had a police presence. So it's an acceptance of this kind of behaviour. They think, well, why have I brought that into the fore? When we look at what is also happening, which I brought out last week about the dollar going down, let me just give you a few more quotes in that regard. It says, soaring debt here, this is from December the 13th, last Monday, soaring debt poses a threat to stability, say the bank. Now this again is over here. The public's insatiable appetite for debt and the rise in credit card borrowing pose a significant threat to future financial stability, the Bank of England says today. And the continuing rapid build-up of debt by many borrowers may be building up vulnerabilities for the long term. Now remember what we just read about the reason for the binge drinking. Why are they going into debt to such a degree? It's the same kind of mentality that is producing this. And if we go on a little bit further, it's talking about the dollar being squeezed by surging oil prices. This is on December the 16th, a couple of days ago. President George Bush said he hoped to send a signal to financial markets yesterday by stressing that he is serious about a strong dollar and the US budget deficits. Well, we'll see. This is November the 24th. It says Russia is set to ditch the dollar reserves for euros. Now, that was back then. And around the world, there is this progressive slide that is taking place. Now, this particular article was sent to me by Mr. Munro. I'm not sure of the actual sourcing of it, but I'll just read some of it, which I think gives a flavour. It says, an all-out run on the dollar is imminent, and from the moment that begins, we'll be living in a whole new world of ruthless and unforgiving. The best way to weaken the American military before fighting it is to eliminate as much of its funding as possible. It says, the core of Roach's analysis is the simple fact that in order to keep the U.S. economy afloat and maintain even moderate faith in the dollar, it must secure, now listen to this, it must secure $2.8 billion a day in foreign investment. It's got to get that level of foreign investment coming into the country, largely through the purchase of treasury notes to service its bubble economy. Other sources have placed the required federal FDI, the foreign direct investment, as $4 billion a day. Suppose they had a bond auction and everybody stayed home. We had a variant of that theme a few months ago during a routine sale of U.S. Treasury bonds in early September. One of the essential pillars holding up the economy suddenly disappeared, and foreigners who had hitherto been regularly buying nearly half of all the debt issued by the U.S. government stayed at home on September the 9th. And if you notice what happened to the dollar after that particular point. Americans are still being encouraged to borrow and spend when they should be warned to cut back and decrease debt. In other words, they want to keep the economy going, and they're doing it on a bubble basis. It's making the ultimate future is becoming worse and worse. It says the dollar will have to crash, but when and how far? Iran plans to open an oil futures trading bureau priced in euros in 2005. That's next year, a few weeks away now. The unthinkable then will become a rational option. It says China will struggle. It says all that may take less than a year. In the meantime, the trick for the rest of the world is how to get out of the dollar before it plummets, and therefore protect foreign currency holdings. It says the signs are unmistakable that a rapid move away from the dollar is underway, as other currencies like the euro, the yen, and the yuan show increasing strength. And the euro is becoming a hostage currency, which the EU wants to weaken so as not to be priced out of the world export market. But once a revolt like this is unleashed, there's no turning back. The world will have to destroy America or be destroyed itself. The battle to control oil reserves continues. Oil is money. Money is valueless without oil. So the link between oil and between the dollar, or between oil and between money, is got to be there. The dollar is sliding against oil. The gold is sliding against oil because it's priced in dollars. And we are having, we're looking down the edge of a precipice. Now, you say, well, how does that fit in with binge drinking? Well, again, God's view of all this is much greater than ours. It's a great deal more than ours. We can see let's ask the question, what happens if the dollar does suddenly crash completely? What then happens? Well, you have mass unemployment. You have a run on the banks. The banks cannot support the money that they have, supposedly, people that have invested. Therefore, the banks go down or are supported by the Bank of England. And you therefore have people who supposedly have money in the bank suddenly find they don't have money in the bank. So what is the result? The result is civil unrest. And this really is what we are seeing today in so many cases. We see bills being pushed through government. And I've brought this out before, but it's becoming more and more apparent that bills are going through government, eroding freedoms that are centuries and centuries old, that quite frankly are the reasons being given. I don't think we're being told the truth. I think people can see the problems within society and see the ensuing chaos that will come, and therefore you have things like the Civil Contingencies Act over here, and the, what's the one in the America, the Patriot Act, was it? Inland Defense, or whatever it is in America. But they see these things as a problem. And we've got the Tories now who are backing the ID card bill. You know, is the ID card going to prevent terrorism? It's crazy. The IT card's not going to prevent terrorism. We've got British nationalists, Muslims, and it's not going to prevent it, but it will allow the government or a state to control its population, and will be able to control and stop somebody and have that ID card, put it into a reader, and immediately go ahead and see just who it is that they're dealing with. And they're working down towards that. There's a letter that went into the Computing magazine, which I thought was quite interesting. And it says here, having a high integrity national ID database could be fabulously useful in the right hands. But what if the data was not in the right hands? And this letter goes on, it says, surely the biometric measurements of a one-month-old infant will have changed radically by the time the same person is 80. So a biometric scan would presumably be carried out every 10 years or so with the passport data, except you can choose when to renew your passport or let it expire if you want to, and no one will come chasing after you. If the National ID Register is to be the linchpin it is intended to be, it will become the means by which the government knows its population. But how would the government know which people needed reminding to have their scan before they're even in the database? In short, how can it be made compulsory? Now, here is where it becomes very important as far as we're concerned. When we start knowing about the mark of the beast, it's not a case, this isn't the mark of the beast. The mark of the beast is to do with Sabbath observance. But the way and the means of implementation of that mark could be by this means. The only way it could be forced upon a population would be to have so many operational, independent systems relying on the national identity. Things that, unlike passport and driving licenses, people need to use on a daily basis, that one couldn't easily exist in society without an ID card. Because when you go down to the bank, when you go down to any transaction, that is the way in which that's really what we're looking at. That's what we're looking at, the means of implementing the problem. Another one from that same Computing magazine. It says, ministers approve proposed database of all children in the UK. Proposals to create a database of all children in the UK have been approved by government ministers, with implementation expected to start next autumn. The plan was first mooted following a public inquiry into the Victoria Klimbay case and was included in the Children's Bill, which became law last month. And last week, a Department for Education and Skills report approved the scheme and confirmed that the system will use a unique identifying number for all children. And it goes on about that particular database. But that has already been begun. And another one, this is November the 26th, the state has a role in the family life, says the minister. The government has the right to intervene in family life because there are social implications in the way parents bring up their children, one of the Tony Blair's closest allies said yesterday. In an interview with the Daily Telegraph, Margaret Hodge, the children's minister, said that the state had always influenced young people's lives throughout school, and she wanted to extend the influence into the home. Now, this is these kind of dictatorial powers, and when we're looking at the right to liberty as opposed to the when he's talking about this bill, of this terrorism bill, you see, at the moment again, there's also a number of people that are in prison without trial. And they're in there indefinitely. They don't know what they've been tried on. They've just basically been put into prison, and they've been kept as a detainee under the anti-terrorism legislation. Now, they're free to leave the country, but they choose not to. They're wanting to stay in Britain. So Britain basically says, right, you're going to have to stay in prison. Now, that is understandable. You can understand that. But it's going in here, it says terrorism versus human rights. It says the government is caught between a rock and a hard place. The rock is the threat from international terrorists and what to do about them. The hard place is that European human rights laws makes it very difficult to do anything. The problem, MI5 has identified a group of people who are foreign nationals who think that they may be plotting terrorist attacks against Britain. What to do? Throw them out of the UK. The problem, you can't. Under Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights, incorporated into the Human Rights Act, the government must not place an individual in a position where they may be ill-treated. It says, no one shall be subject to torture or inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. The courts have interpreted this to mean that a foreign national cannot be removed to a country where he may face such treatment, including the death penalty. And you can guarantee that that will not be the case as we go into the future. But it goes down here, back and forth on the various laws that they're bringing in and the conflict with the terrorism problem. There's another one, 250 hunts to mount mass protest on the first day of a new ban. The ban on fox hunting will be met on its opening day. So basically, as far as this terrorism is concerned, the laws, they're not about terrorists. The laws that they extend further than just terrorism. It goes into the common, ordinary citizen. It is a change in the fundamentals of our laws. And here, ban on fox hunting will be met on its opening day by mass protests involving more than 250 hunts across the country. It emerged last night. This was last Sabbath. The Countryside Alliance said that on the very first hunting day after the ban becomes law on Saturday, the February the 19th, the hunts will gather as normal, but in a major change of tactics. They'll not seek to break the law in a mass exercise of civil disobedience. Instead, huntsmen and women will go about their business lawfully and sensibly, and it goes in and how they're going to actually do this, and the police are not going to be able to, they think, not be able to go ahead and do anything about it. The problem is, the way the acts are being worded, is that if there's anything, any kind of problem that is going to have a destruction of the environment, that they can go ahead and cause the implementation of these bills. And they can cause the confiscation of goods without any reason. They can break up meetings without giving any reason. And on that goes. Now, what I would like to do, I'd like to read a little bit from Winston Churchill's The History of the English-Speaking Peoples. And I think this then starts to give a little bit more of understanding as to, you know, the way God looks at things, because God looks at things in a broader perspective than we do. We see these isolated laws, we see these isolated, you know, binge drinking, we see the fact that the dollar's going down, we see the fact that there are laws being passed which are dictatorial in their scope. What I'd just like to read, let's see if I can find the first page, 217 here. I'd just like to read some from this book, and this is volume one, the Birth of Britain. And he's talking about Henry II. Now, Henry the Second, Henry Plantagenet, he was he a grandson, or I'm not sure whether he was a grandson of William the Conqueror. But it says here, it says, "A debate was needed." This is talking about Henry. "A bait was needed with which to draw litigants to the royal courts. The king must offer them better justice than they could have had in the hands of their lords." Now, what happened was that Henry, in fact, no, let me go, before I read that, let me just read this other one, I think. It probably is better. Let me read this one first. It says, "A bait was needed which would draw litigants to the royal courts. The king must offer them better justice than they could have had in the hands of their lords. Henry accordingly threw away to the open to the litigants in the royal courts a startling new procedure, trial by jury." Now, this occurred back, the actual year here, or you're looking at about 1200. It says regal quodam beneficium, in other words, it's a royal benefit, a contemporary called it, a royal boon, as he translated it. "And the description illuminates both the origin of the jury and the part it played in the triumph of the common law." Now, Henry was trying to pull the country together, and the barons obviously held their own courts. But what he did was he established royal courts around the country. And in establishing the royal courts, obviously the people could go wherever they wanted to, as far as the courts were concerned. But the thing that he implemented was a trial by jury. Trial by jury was given to give the fairness within the English system. It said Henry did not invent the jury. He put it to a new purpose. "The idea of the jury is the one great contribution of the Franks to the English legal system. For unknown in this country before the conquest, the germ of it lies far back in the practice of the Carolingian kings. I'm not sure what the Carolingian kings are. I should really look that word up. But the Franks. Now, if you go and trace the Frankish kingdoms back, where do they go to? The Caspian Sea, down to Troy and the Caspian Sea and back into that area. You're looking at something that is going back into ancient history and almost certainly coming out of the concepts of ancient Israel. So let's just, in that light, just turn over to Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 17. Because this is what we are now seeing eroded in this country and also in America as well. And I think it's worth just going on in this regard. It says in verse 14, "When you are come into the land which the Eternal your God gives you, and shall possess it, and you shall dwell therein, and shall say, I will set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me." Now this was Samuel, who added this into the law. The law, Deuteronomy was written by Moses, but under the canonization period of Samuel, he added this section after they insisted on a king. He added this section into Deuteronomy. It says, "You shall in any way set him king over you, who the Eternal your God shall choose. One from among your brethren shall you set king over you, that you may not set a stranger over you which is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Eternal has said to you, you shall henceforth return no more that way," not to go back that direction. "Neither shall he multiply wives to himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. And it shall be, when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom, that he will write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests of the Levites." Now this is something else. Now, we're looking at Henry II here, who, just keep your hand in there, because we'll just read a little bit more, and just to see what in fact happened and how it goes back to this time. And it's coming, as I mentioned here, coming from the Franks, and it goes back into prehistory. On page 222, Winston Churchill writes, it says, "It was in these faithful and formative years," this is of Henry II, "that the English-speaking peoples began to devise methods of determining legal disputes which survive in substance to this day. A man can only be accused of a civil or criminal offence which is clearly defined and known to the law. The judge is an umpire. He adjudicates on such evidence as the parties choose to produce. Witnesses must testify in public and on oath, and they are examined and cross-examined not by the judge, but by the litigants themselves, or their legally qualified and privately hired representatives. The truth of this testimony is weighed not by the judge, but by 12 good men and true, and it is only when this jury has determined the facts that the judge is empowered to impose sentence, punishment or penalty according to law." This might seem very obvious, even a platitude, until one contemplates the alternative system which still dominates a large portion of the world. Under Roman law, and systems derived from it, and that's the continent, in a trial of those turbulent centuries, and in some countries even today, it's often an inquisition. You know, the Spanish Inquisition was the Roman law. That's what it was. It was the way they went about it. The judge makes his own investigation into the civil wrong or the public crime, and such investigation is largely uncontrolled. In other words, the judge hasn't got the answer to anybody. The suspect can be interrogated in private. He must answer all questions put to him. His right to be represented by a legal advisor is restricted. The witnesses against him can testify in secret and in his absence. Does that sound familiar to what we're actually having and seeing today? And only when these processes have been accomplished is the accusation or charge against him formulated and published. This often arises in secret intimidation, enforced confessions, torture, blackmail, pleas of guilty, and these sinister dangers were extinguished from the common law of England more than 6 centuries ago. By the time Henry II's great-grandson Edward I had died, English criminal and civil procedures had settled into a mould and tradition which in a mass governed the English-speaking peoples, that's not just here, but the peoples of the English-speaking peoples, in other words, Ephraim and Manasseh, today. In all claims and disputes, whether they concern the grazing lands of the Middle West, that's the Middle West of America, the oil fields of California, the sheep runs and gold mines of Australia, or the territorial rights of the Maoris. These rules have obtained, at any rate in theory, according to the procedure and mode of trial evolved by the English common law. That's where it came from. And where did it come from? The Franks. Where did it come from? From here, what it says here. Now, when you come to King John, you know, from Henry II, you go down to Richard the Lionheart, and then his brother, John. And John had to go and sign the Magna Carta. The barons actually put it into, at Runningmede, which is just by Heathrow Airport, but they put it into law that John was subject to the laws. And if I just read what Winston Churchill actually says here about the Magna Carta, says, "If the 13th century magnates understood little and cared less for popular liberties or parliamentary democracy, they had all the same laid hold of a principle which was to be of prime importance for the future development of English society and English institutions. Throughout the document it is implied that there is a law which is above the king and which even he must not break." Now this is something totally different. This is something totally, you know, when you have the Roman law, and the, you know, you go back, and where does Roman law come from? It comes from Babylon. Where does English law come from? It comes from this book in here in Deuteronomy 28, where it says, you know, let's just finish this reading. It says, "And it shall be when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom," that's verse 18, Deuteronomy 17, "that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests of the Levites, and it will be with him, and he will read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Eternal his God, and to keep all the words of this law and these statutes, and do them." The law was above the king. And that was written by Samuel, back in, what is it, 1000 plus BC. that his heart may not be lifted up above the brethren, and that he must be turned not aside from the commandment to the right hand or the left to his end, that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. Now there's that, therefore, this basic central philosophy came from the ancient Israelites down through the centuries, ending up on the time of Runnymede and the implementation of the Magna Carta. And it says here, in going back to what Winston Churchill said, it says, throughout the document it is implied that there's a law which is above the king, and that he even must not break. The reaffirmation of a supreme law and its expression in a general charter is the great work of the Magna Carta. The Great Charter, that's what it means. And this alone justifies the respect in which men have held it. The reign of Henry II, according to the most respected authorities, initiated the rule of law, but the work as yet was incomplete. The crown was still above the law, and the legal system which Henry had created could become, as John showed, an instrument of oppression. Now, with John having signed this Magna Carta, now for the first time, the king himself is bound by the law. The root principle was destined to survive across the generations and arise paramount long after the feudal background of 1215 had faded in the past, which is the signing of the Magna Carta. The charter became in the process of time an enduring witness to the power of the crown was not absolute. The facts embodied in it and the circumstances giving rise to them were buried or misunderstood. He's talking about the feudal system. The underlying idea of the sovereignty of law, long existent in feudal custom, was raised by it into a doctrine for the national state. And when in subsequent ages the state, swollen with its own authority, has attempted to ride roughshod over the rights or liberties of the subjects, it is to this doctrine that appeal has again and again been made, and never, as yet, without success. Now that was the chapter on the Magna Carta, and the way that the law of the UK, and a law of it's not just the UK, it's a law of the UK, of America, of Canada, of Australia, of New Zealand, wherever the English-speaking peoples have gone. You're looking back to this time of the Magna Carta, and you're looking back to this time of Henry II, and you're looking to from them, and they got it from the Franks, and it goes all the way back to the Caspian Sea, and it goes right back here to Samuel. And you're looking in Deuteronomy. And what we are witnessing today is we are witnessing by the back door an erosion of this fundamental. We are witnessing the erosion of the rule of law over the government themselves. The government becomes a law to themselves, and this time of emergency can be, you know, can basically wipe out people's liberties. These are, you know, these are monumental times that we are in, absolutely monumental. And it's fine, you know, all these laws that are being passed at the moment, you know, it doesn't affect us until you have a problem, until the dollar goes through the floor and you get civil unrest on the streets. These laws will then be implemented, and it will be within our own country. Now we need to be aware of this. You know, we need to be appreciating just what time we're in. This is not going to just kind of waltz on forever. It will not. And we need to be aware, and we need to be have the kind of view that God has, which is a much more global view. It's a much more detailed. A thousand years is a day. And a thousand years is a day. The Magna Carta was actually implemented only at the beginning of Thursday night, wouldn't it? Thursday night, waiting for the Sabbath to come on the Friday. You're looking at King David, you're going back to maybe, Tuesday, something, or Wednesday, something like that. So this is the way God looks at it. It looks at the unfolding of history. But this is what we are now looking at. It is the change from this system based on what we see here in Deuteronomy 17 across into the Inquisition. That's the justice that is going across. And we better make sure we understand that.